Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Yeah, since we're coming in a little late here, we'll not let the music play out. And say that, yes, we do have the guest that was promised for this evening, Bob Emmenegger, who is probably best known to this audience as the producer, director, writer. He's probably going to correct me there. Of a documentary called UFOs Past, Present, and Future that was released in 1974. And the drama with the U.S. Air Force and the Department of Defense leading up to that, and some information they were saying they were going to disclose and then didn't, and the fallout of that is has been told before, but not in the detail we're going to get into it tonight. So, Bob, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Was that a fair introduction?
Well, I thought the music was very dramatic. I was waiting to turn into a horror movie or something.
You know what that opening is from?
No.
Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Okay. Well, anyway, we can get into whatever you want to talk about.
Okay. I don't know why I have that opening. I guess I just like it because it explains so much about why I do what I do. Probably because I want to, just like Ed Wood did. No matter what the quality.
Well, it was fun.
So what happened, maybe you can tell us what happened leading up. Why would you want to do a documentary on UFOs in the first place? What got you into, you know, you didn't have a sighting when you were young or anything like that I know of.
No, not at all. Well, maybe I could go back a little bit and say that, my background was in advertising. I was the VP creative director of Gray Advertising. As a matter of fact, the Mad Men show that's on really brings back memories. You know, Don Draper, who's the creative director, or have you watched the television series?
You mean, which one? Mad Men?
Mad Men.
Yes, I have not seen
AMC.
It. Yeah, I cannot help but have heard of it, but no, I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, well, it's great. It just reminds me of my early years, which has nothing to do with UFOs especially, except that's what I was doing before I got involved with the UFO project. Well, at the time, I was, Gray Advertising may not mean anything to you, but I was creative director of it for a while.
It was a big firm.
During that time, a friend of mine had a studio, Alan Sandler. We did a lot of commercials together, like for Bank of America or Honda. There was several clients. And while I was, during that time, we did a couple freelance projects that Alan had brought aboard, which I was really sort of midnight doing it. So, that wasn't my original whole assignment. But the Navy needed a film that would help identify if they had an alcohol problem on the Navy on submarines. So that's where we put together that it was a drug program. And that's when we had Rod Serling sort of the host for that particular program.
Yeah.
And then I had Tommy Smothers do another one. And then I hope I'm not jumping around too much. But then we had an assignment about the spaceship. Trying to convince the public that sending up the space shuttle it was only about 2 cents per year income tax, and that we didn't quite finish with that one. But anyway, we did do the one on alcoholism with Serling. And then at that time, Colin said, we're going out to Norton Air Force Base to, they were interested in sort of a documentary that might put the DOD in a better light. At that time in the 70s, it seems to be, was sagging a little bit. So, we went out there with the full intention of doing something dramatic for them. We looked at all their R&D projects, and they have done some incredible projects, that the public doesn't know about. Like, one of them was, are you familiar with DARPA?
Yes, of course.
Defense
Advanced Research Project Agency.
Yes, and they, we had orders, everybody had orders to cooperate with us. So we sat down at DARPA at one meeting where a young man, a scientist, was working with a computer where the mind, he would think something and then the computer would say the word. And that was the early days of that technique, that technology. He had about 7 to 10 words that he would think and the computer would then go, and say, like, dog, it would pop up. And I think it was really used for pilots to extend their abilities, in other words, they had things on their shoulders that would tell them if they're too much to the left or to the right or if they're falling asleep.
Oh,
so
right.
that was one. Then the Navy was doing fission, atomic fission. We had three-dimensional moving holography that the Navy, again, was involved with. We even talked about, with the Navy, maybe as an incident, pulling up the Merrimack, which they had the ability to do. We never got around to that.
I know what you're talking about. The Merrimack being the first basically, like, submarine-type ship that was used in the Civil War.
It was a ship that had sunk somewhere.
It sunk off Cape Hatteras, I think.
Yeah. Then the some of the other things were, for instance, I was permitted to wander around at Wright-Patterson to see all their laser work. I should go back and say, I'm jumped ahead on what we're doing. We had sort of the blessings of the Department of Defense to do whatever it was. They opened every door for us to see what kind of technologies that they were involved in, out of which we would pick one or two and try and make a presentation of it. I was fascinated. You know, we went to Wright-Patterson, and I remember wandering around in the laser department where a young guy was burning a hole in a brick with oxygen laser beams, and then another one where they were trying to generate 100,000 watts at the back end of a jet engine for what reason I couldn't quite figure out, except maybe we're going to have laser cannons on some of our ships, which I found out that it wasn't effective. It just burned a hole in the enemy and where they said the old-fashioned bomb that goes up their rear end and explodes was much better. So after doing all of this exploration, I should say, you know, this all started at Norton Air Force Base, or did I mention that?
No, you didn't.
We went out to Norton, which is the depository for all films, and that's where the CIA does their filmmaking and all. And I must say, incidentally, that I was stationed at Norton Air Force Base when I was very young and put on active duty for 11 months out at Norton, along with Bruce Hershenson. You either know who Bruce is or you don't. He was a newscaster out on the West Coast. He also ran for senator. And when I ran into Bruce again, he was an aide to Nixon. So I was in constant correspondence with him at the White House, but I'm jumping ahead. You know, I'll go back to... So back at Norton, we were gathering our information, and then we were taken into what was called a clean room at Norton. Norton, that clean room is a studio that the CIA does their training films in, so whatever we were talking about in that room, you know, no one would hear it. So remember, I didn't know UFOs from anything. And as we sat there, he just simply said, what would you think if we told you we had a landing at Holloman Air Force Base of an alien craft, and it had been filmed, and I can give you all the details of it, and if you're interested, we'll set up a liaison with the Pentagon, but we suggest, he suggests that we bury that under the other ones, which are, you know, legitimate. In other words, he said that you start off by talking about UFOs and it sends up a red flag. And so we dutifully went and investigated all of these things at DARPA, the Navy, three-dimensional holography, and so forth.
Uh-huh.
Well, that began the projects. That began it. So we had a, Alan is smarter than I am about business. We had a legal contract with the Department of Defense that they had the right to look at everything we're doing and have the final say on it. So off we went to the Pentagon with the idea that we're going to be looking into not only those other projects, but the UFO thing was the main thrust, which we're trying to bury. So I remember that when we went to the Pentagon, we didn't sign in, you know, for whatever reason. They just have denial that they ever knew that we were there, I suppose, is what they could say. The first people we met were the plainclothesmen about wondering what we were doing and convinced them that that we were invited there after they scared or tried to scare our pants off. At least they did me. Alan didn't seem to be bothered by it. So he said, Alan said, well, we're you know, your guest. We're the guest of the Pentagon. He said, oh, okay, you're right. Up we went upstairs and met. That's where I first met Colonel Coleman. Bill Coleman was like Pentagon spokesman at the time. And I don't want to get into too many details that you don't care about, but when we were standing out in the hall, Coleman said, you know, if you get in, if you run across something that is jeopardizing a national security or some information that you shouldn't be know about, you know, you can be put in jail and 10,000 other things can happen to you. And I just thought, God, what are we getting into? But then he whisked us inside his office, sat down, and then he told us that, he said, I know what you're after. He said, you know, when I was flying, other people have probably heard this before. When I was flying a B-25 over Alabama with a 7-man crew, he said, I pursued a UFO, and it went over a plowed field, and I could see it kicking up the vortex of dust. And he said, I could, you know, the thing doesn't go that fast, it's B-25, but he tried to pursue it. It went up behind some trees and disappeared. Now, he came back. He was concerned because his job was to interface with the press talking about updates on Project Blue Book. And he told his commanding officer, he said, you know, I had this experience. It's not in Blue Book. They left it out. And he said, that's fine. You just keep that to yourself. And so here's the guy who has to report to the press about updates on Project Blue Book. And he knew. He knew it's a reality. He still does. Then we just move forward. Tell me when you're bored, by the way. I'll jump forward with these stories.
Well, I'm not bored. I'm fascinated by the story. It just seems kind of weird. And we talked about this a little bit before the show, that the Air Force would say, hey, would you guys like a UFO film? You wouldn't expect that the Air Force would ever do such a thing. In this day and age, it's completely different now.
You know, he didn't quite put it, would you like a UFO film? That was not the line. It was, we had a landing at Holloman. It had been filmed by our TDY, temporary duty guy.
Yeah.
And they named who the person was. And the film was supposed to be coming, another copy or something, coming out to Norton, where they send all undeveloped film. So at that time, they didn't say, you know, I was, my tongue was hanging out going, my God, UFOs, I never believed in them. So I could see that that had to be some sort of conclusion to whatever project we were going to do. Well, anyway, so when we were in Coleman's office, this is at the Pentagon, he said, you know, I know somebody that could be helpful to you, and that is Colonel George Weinbrenner. He got George Weinbrenner on the phone. Now, I don't know if you know who he is, but George Weinbrenner was his commander of foreign technology, which is the spy center for the Air Force, and all the most critical stuff goes through foreign technology. So he set up an appointment and a meeting, and I remember this. Now we went to Wright-Patterson. I don't remember if Alan was with me or not, because we'd split up the places we were going to be going. And I walked down the corridor, and I think this is, by the way, on the History Channel, I remember talking about this, when going down this long corridor and Wright-Patterson coming up to his desk, and the opening question is, to him, I said, what about the landing of an alien craft at Holloman Air Force Base? I mean, I'm going to test the waters. I might as well.
Yeah.
He could have said, what the fuck are you talking about? You know, or something like that. He didn't. He just said, well, you know, the Soviets know all about us, and we know very little about them. We have to go to the air shows to see what they're doing. Although Benny did say, by the way, and he went up to a blackboard, and he said the Israelis captured for us a MiG. I think it was a MiG-16 or whatever number it was. But he drew a picture on a blackboard. It wasn't a bad drawing. It was just, here we are talking about MiGs. And then he jumped from the MiGs to saying, well, the problem we really have now is with weather alteration. He said, the Soviets are quite a bit ahead of us. But he said, I have the best scientist working on counter strategies. And then he reached up behind me, and there was a bookshelf, and he pulled a book out. He said, scientists like this, and plopped down in my lap a book which said to my good friend, George Weinbrenner, signed Dr. Alan Hynek. Uh-huh. And it was Hynek, all on UFOs. Weinbrenner never mentioned the word UFOs, but somehow I had an idea that he's acknowledging what we're saying, but he never mentioned about Holloman again. He just skipped right over that. And he said, you know, I used to have a Mexican officer that worked for me, and he was always talking about UFOs and aliens and all of that, and he made up stories. And I thought, that's interesting. I wonder what the heck he's talking about. The following morning, we get a call from Hector Quintanilla. Do you know who he is?
Yes, he used to be the head of Blue Book.
Colonel Hector Quintanilla was head of Project Blue Book, and I guess about in the 60s.
I think he was the last one.
Go ahead.
I think he might have been the last head of Project Blue Book, or he was for quite a while, anyway.
Yes, that's exactly right. He was the last one. So, the following morning, I get a call and says, hi, this is Colonel Hector Quintanilla. George said, maybe I could help you. I thought, boy, it's like a Kafka play. You know, you ask a question, another answer comes back unrelated, and pretty soon he's talking about, you know, some Mexican colonel. No, he didn't say colonel, just somebody, a Mexican guy that worked for him. Turns out to be Hector Quintanilla.
Yeah.
So from there it was Jacques Vallée was involved, but much earlier. From there we met Bob Friend, joined us, and then everybody involved with UFOs were offered. They weren't offered to us. They just sort of fell into our laps.
Who was offering these people to you?
Well, it started with Coleman. He suggested Weinbrenner. Weinbrenner suggested Quintanilla. And then Hynek, we knew we'd have to. Now we'd have to work with him. So he was aboard. And then Bob Friend was brought. And Al Chop came into the picture. And it's like we had this wonderful array of people who were experienced with the UFO phenomenon. I remember once asking Coleman, and I've asked him very recently too, I said, why are you talking to us? And he said, because the Secretary of the Air Force said to do it. So my impression was that their time had passed, Blue Book was closed, and they wanted something to clear the air. That's the only thing I can think of. Maybe. Yeah, that's all I can tell you. So we proceeded. Whatever we did, they had the right to review it, and they did. They really questioned very little. And then we get around to Holloman, as you know. And I thought, well, we have all of this material. Now, by the way, back to Jacques Vallée, as the material was starting to come together, Jacques started talking about the history. He provided us all of the background of early history of UFO stuff. And someone named, what was his name? Ron Jacobs, I think, who became famous on his own. He was like a young guy who was just getting started on UFO stuff. He was gathering material for us, too. And then we knew that the only thing we could do was to go down to, I wanted to go to Holloman and find out. I thought, here's the place it landed. We might as well go down and check it out and ask questions.
Yeah, of course.
And by the way, I'm going to back up for 1 second, something I remembered. While we're getting all of this go-ahead, Alan got a call from Major... why am I drawing a blank on his name? I should know it offhand. He was the major who was the big shot in UFOs prior to us ever getting involved. Major Kehoe.
Okay. Yeah, Donald Kehoe.
Kehoe called us on the phone, and Alan talked to him. He said he'd talked to the Secretary of the Air Force, and he was mad as hell that two civilians would be have all this cooperation. And then, of course, you know, I didn't know I had heard of Kehoe's name, but it didn't mean anything to me one way or another.
Yeah.
But I thought that was kind of funny or interesting. He said he did call the Secretary of the Air Force complaining. What are these two guys, you know? Are they journalists, or what right do they have to be, you know, open to all this information?
Yeah, that he wasn't allowed to look at.
I guess that's true. Maybe it's because we were fresh beans that we got, and also I think we'd been cleared long before this anyway. As I told you, I'm still thinking back on, I did a lot of those USO shows, and I was stationed at Holloman, and we went through a lot of clearances just to do the USO shows, and we spent maybe a couple of years going to every, all through Germany, England, China, not China, but Taiwan, South Korea, the Philippines, you know, even Morocco. And we were exposed to a lot of the secret bases. And we were cleared. I can't tell you why. I don't think that they let people wander around unless they do vet them pretty heavily. So the fact that I had been in the Air Force and did a lot of USO shows, maybe that was the beginning.
I'm wondering why Coleman said what he was saying, and
you mean about why he would admit having that experience?
Yeah, that, and why he was saying what he was saying when you were in his office. I mean, they said they wanted to help you do a documentary about the UFO subject, and all he does is talk about nothing but the UFO subject while showing you this book to imply something.
I think what happened was that we decided that we're going to go for. Very openly now. By now, we had passed all the barriers, and we could talk strictly about UFOs. From that point forward, it was all UFO stuff. But in the beginning, we were exposed to all kinds of R&D things. I guess just to satisfy the fact that maybe we're working on a PR film for DOD, but it's slowly and finally shifted into only UFO. And everybody knew we were doing that. I mean, and as I said to Coleman, why is everybody talking to us? He said it came down as an order. And it must have, because I don't think, you know, people wander around the Pentagon talking about things like that without somebody approving it. I mean, I was very grateful for it. It was a wonderful experience, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, it just seems strange that, just like Kehoe said, why you and why then? You know what?
Yeah.
What was the? You know, you said it was transitioning from Blue Book, which had ended in 1969. You started working on your film in 1972. What air were they trying to clear? That a bad taste in their mouth about Blue Book and how people thought it was basically a cover up? Or
I think so. I think that now Hal Puthoff told me he got the impression that the naval intelligence wanted to allow us to do this so that maybe the scientific community would begin to take seriously the UFO thing and get involved in it. apparently it didn't quite do the trick for them, quote unquote, you know, but it just, you know, it's so hard to know what's going on behind the scenes. And because I was unfamiliar with the UFO things, I had no prejudice whatsoever about it. I didn't disbelieve it. I didn't believe it. I thought, wow, this is quite interesting. So, but anyway, we knew that the most important thing would be to go to down to Holloman. Alan is kind of impulsive. By the way, I just noticed a note here. It's the whole time that we did have a CIA guy named Dick Besk hanging around the office all the time. So they were somehow, the intelligence community was quite aware of what we were doing. In fact, let me go up even earlier than that. One of the first people to come down from San Francisco to meet Alan and I before we began was Hal Puthoff and Targ from the Stanford Research, you know, and were friends of Jacques Vallée.
Right.
So everyone kind of knew something was cooking.
And who told them to come down and meet you?
Yes, to find out what we were up to.
Oh, who told them to come down and meet you? Who had them do that, or did they just hear about it?
I think they did it on their own. I think that I think Jacques Vallée, who was aware of what we were doing, probably said, "Why don't you guys go down to Los Angeles?" And they just appeared. That was the first time I'd ever seen them. They were wonderful guys. I still talk to Puthoff a lot. I really adore the guy. He's a brilliant person. And he really keeps to himself, and
yeah.
he's one of the people who I think is so straight arrow and no BS. That's what I really admire about the guy. So I do call him every so often to say, "What do you think?" or "What's going on?" Another person that appeared was Stanton Freeman, and he had a Russian document. It was in Russian. And he would love to have had a translation. Well, apparently, foreign technology, they have a computer that you just simply feed the information into the computer and it gives you a translation. We didn't really want to... I like Stanton a lot, but he was sort of an... I won't say he's an outsider, but he was not part of the military.
Yeah.
So we gave him a copy of the translation, and... Foreign Technology kept a copy of it for their own use. Now, I know this probably sounds kind of odd, all of these things, like why? I can't even answer you why.
What did the document say that Friedman gave to you?
I think it was just, because I don't remember reading it, but it was the experiences that the Soviets have had with UFO phenomenon. That's what it was basically about. Secret stuff.
Where did he say he got it from?
Say it again, I can't...
Oh, I'm sorry. Where did he say that the document had come from? How did it come into his hands?
Well, I never asked him how he came by it. We just said he just wanted to let us take a look at it. And the only way we could even figure out what it was is to have it translated. And the quickest way was through Wright Patterson.
Uh-huh.
So, I'm sure everybody was wondering, what the hell are we up to? Well, I don't know either. It just is the way it worked out. Alan and I also did research with the dolphins. And one of the interesting things about the dolphin project... Now, I have to go back again way to the top, which was... Alan used to do the filming for Dr. Hammer... in the Soviet Union. So he had a connection with the Soviet Union. Dr. Armin Hammer, are you familiar with
him? Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And later on, that would pay off by doing some intelligence gathering on a Soviet defector, which we got drawn into, and I'll kind of go down further. Where this had to do with the dolphins. I am jumping around a little bit, but what the hell?
Oh, that's all right.
Nobody's keeping score. Was
this
the... We met with the dolphin people, and it was very interesting. We found how they trained them to recognize different kinds of metals, copper, lead, iron, where they would, you'd tell them to go, you know, touch the plate that's got copper, and it would swim off and catch its nose on it. I hate to think that they were training it to carry a bomb or something and blow up a ship. I don't know. I don't think so. God, I hope they weren't doing that. But they were training them to retrieve bombs that had not discharged, and they had a little harness that they put around their body, and they would go down and touch the, the bomb, and they had these things that clamped around it, and then they would come and retrieve it. I never saw that in action. I just know that that's what they were doing. Now, there was something, I suppose, by now, it doesn't matter. Nobody's going to say that we're spies or anything, but they asked us, this is after the fact, this is probably after we had finished our UFO thing, the Navy said, would you help us to identify, we have somebody's a Russian defector working with our Navy, and would we help film to see if he's telling the correct hand signals, and is he really telling us the truth about the way the Russians do work with dolphins? So we went out on a fishing boat with this Soviet guy and the whole crew, and they went out picking up bottlenose dolphins while we're grinding away making what he probably thought was an educational film. And I don't know if this is still classified or not. Anyway, so Alan said, well, to find out if he's telling the truth, he made an arrangement in the Soviet Union for them to film some work with the dolphins for under the guise that we were making an educational film on dolphins.
Oh, so, I see.
You know, after, you know how what money just flows out when you're doing some silly intelligence gathering. So the film came back of the Soviets working with the dolphins, and everybody gathered around the moviola. And then after a few months, I go, okay, I guess he's okay. I mean, all of that intrigue over, yeah, he's okay. To find, you know, a few $1,000 just to find out that somebody was telling the truth. Does
yeah,
that
well,
sound crazy, or is that the way it works?
Well, it doesn't sound crazy to me, because the information they were getting from him, if they could vet him enough that he appeared to be telling the truth, and they could probably trust some of the other information that was coming out.
Because
there was a lot of double agent stuff going. There still is. But a lot of double agent and information gathering, intelligence gathering going on in the 1970s. It was right in the middle of the Cold War. So if they needed that guy to tell them something.
That's exactly when we were hot and heavy in that whole thing.
Yeah, I didn't know that you had been involved in other things with the DOD besides the UFO film. And it's funny because Bill Moore when I wrote about him in the Benowitz book, he was also involved with stuff that had nothing to do with UFOs, and it had more to do with catching spies and agents in the country and things like that. So it doesn't surprise me that you were multitasking.
I wondered quite a bit about Moore. I liked him as a person. But I couldn't. There were reasons that I didn't trust anything he says, because he was involved in sending, I'm sure he's the one who did it, sent these postcards from like Afghanistan saying that Nixon nixed our involvement with the UFO thing. It was just like bullshit stuff.
Really?
I don't know why.
I've never heard this.
That.
You think Moore sent those postcards from postmarked in Afghanistan?
Yes. How else would? Because both Moore and Jean Duret came to our house, they were the only ones that knew I sat when we talked about things in general, and I think they were the only ones that knew about Nixon and the UFO project, because I would talk about him in front of them. Then all of a sudden, when that program came up called UFO Cover-Up Live from Washington, D.C.?
Yes, 1988.
Yeah, well, during that time, they said, it must have been before that when we were just thinking about it. They said, we got these postcards, and they were saying that Nixon said he was going to nix our involvement with it. It's like, what the hell are they talking about? What does that have to do with anything? It was like a game, like creating a game. That's my opinion, anyway. I doubt very much if those postcards were anything other than more of the game playing that Doty and Collins and Moore and Shonda Rae get involved in.
Yeah, well,
I like the guys. Bill Moore gave our daughter a cat. I mean, you know, a little kitten once.
Oh.
So from that point of view, and a personal point of view, I thought he was great. But they made up too many little wild-ass stories, including when we did UFO Cover-Up Live from Washington, D.C., flying off and getting Doty and Collins to pretend like they were intelligence officers with their face hidden in that UFO Cover-Up Live show.
Yeah.
Bullshitting about, you know, that they had met with aliens and the aliens liked strawberry ice cream. Thing is, I was quite aware where they were and what they were doing. I guess maybe I told you that. I'm not sure.
No, because I've forgotten that you were on that show. They talked to you as one of the interview subjects.
Yes, right. In fact, I brought in the two military people, Bob Friend and Coleman.
Oh, okay.
That was my contribution. And that was such a weird, horrible program. I knew who Seligman was because Seligman used to produce projects for my old advertising agency. And a lot of people thought that Gray Advertising was slightly behind that program. Well, it wasn't at all. Seligman was just an independent producer who did programs for profit. You remember all those things. If you think you have you ever seen a UFO, if you have, called 1-800-da-da-da-da-da, and that'll cost you a dollar. If you've never seen one, call in. If you wish you could see one, call in this number, and that'll cost you a dollar too. It was just sort of like a horrible money-making proposition. I don't think it was a very good program personally.
Well, most people didn't think it was a very good program. Anybody that knew what was going on, I asked Moore's view of it, and he said, we had a script. I mean, we had these people coming in. We talked to them. We had things ready to go, and then they had to have this script approved beforehand.
The military had no interest in this thing. That was a wonderful cover-up, wasn't it? Seligman is a... Oh, I don't know. What can I tell you? In fact, you know, everything I said was put on a teleprompter, and so was everybody else's.
Yeah, well, that's what he said. Everything was scripted down to the last minute, which he said he didn't agree with. Bob, that wasn't it. What he told me was that Emenegger got scared and he wanted everything on the teleprompters because he didn't want people going off the script. That's what the problem was.
You mean Seligman?
Seligman. Yeah, Seligman, I'm sorry. He wanted everything on a script, scripted down to the last word so they wouldn't go off of it.
That is absolutely true because he's used to doing programs that are timed to the gnat's ass and mostly, you know, entertainment programs like the Emmy Awards or something. That's what he's used to producing, so that's why he wanted everything scripted. Not because of any approval, just that for timing reasons.
And also, apparently, he was nervous about working with the Defense Department and the Air Force for some reason that he was never...
What, he didn't work with them. I mean,
well,
he worked with Coleman, and I don't think the Defense Department gave a shit what he was doing, to tell you the truth.
Well, the people involved in the show wanted things to be a certain way, no matter who they were.
The producer did. That's the one, if you want to...
Well, he did lay most of the blame on Seligman, saying, we're going to do this. First, he said, we're going to do this just as an interview show. And then suddenly he said, within a week or less of the show airing, suddenly he wanted everything scripted. So they had to go back and do it from the beginning. And it made it even more difficult to say what they wanted to say and to make it the show look good and to flow properly. And it made it actually worse. So. But the thing is, I think it was kind of doomed from the beginning.
You're absolutely right. He is so used to doing a button-down, I want to know what's going on every minute, and that's what happened to the show. I think if any other producer had been involved, it wouldn't have been so sterile. I don't know. It was Seligman who was the one who made that thing so awkward.
Yeah, it seemed very awkward and stilted, the whole thing, and that... I think it's probably in Project Beta. I did actually mention what what the problem was with the scripting, and that that everybody on the show was suddenly thinking, why do I have to read this? I already know what my story is.
Did I ever tell you? I don't know. I knew who Seligman was, and I kind of stuck it to him once. And when, unless I've already told you this, Mike Farrell, you're sitting there, we're rehearsing. Tell me because I thought it was funny.
No, yeah, this is a program. We haven't heard this on the air yet. Go right ahead.
With that?
Go right ahead.
Anyway, Mike Farrell said to me, Bob, when the craft came down, then what happened? And I didn't read the script. I just said, well, the door opened up and out came Bigfoot. Seligman screamed from the control room. He said, read the teleprompter. He had a fit. So you could, but I looked and I remember I thought, am I in this show? As I watched it once, I thought, everything seems so sterile. But anyway, the thing that troubled me more than anything, that was one thing that bothered me about this program, the Falcon and Condor behind the screen, you know, pretending to be intelligence officer, really bugged me. So I went into Seligman's office, and I looked around, gathering a little intelligence, and I could see that there were some air tickets down to Kirtland. And I thought, I know what's going on. They're going down to get their buddies, Condor and Falcon. So it was not, and I thought, I wondered if they're going to do some shenanigan stuff. I did, at that time, I did have a CIA connection, and I asked them, called them, and said, I think you'd better watch this show, because I think there's going to be a couple of people representing the intelligence community, I don't know in which branch, and I think you should stand by if you want to, you know, comment on it. And I told Seligman I was doing that, and he was very unhappy that I even did that. But they decided to stand down. Said, you know, we'll watch the show, but, you know, I don't think we will get involved in it. So they stood down. But the thing that bothered me so much is that for those guys to get away with making the public think that they were really intelligence officers and had met with a alien who ate ice cream, strawberry ice cream.
Yeah, I don't know what the point of that was either, except just to make the subject look silly.
Well, I thought it was so silly. Yeah, that's what I thought. But it made me leery of whatever whatever Bob Collins and Doty would ever say or do. It made me question their integrity, because, you know, I don't think you'd go around screwing around making up stuff just to amuse yourself.
No, it's done for a reason. I mean, it's done on probably on orders, if not direct ones, at least orders where they tell you to do things and under your own, the way you see fit, which is the way that the Air Force AFOSI operates in some cases. They sort of give their agents free hand.
I'm sorry. We're kind of making cross things here.
Go ahead.
But it bothered me, and I later on, I wanted to know what they had done with Benowitz, and so, as I told you, I traced down Doty through the military computer, which, forgive me, you're not supposed to talk about it. And I knew, I found he was eventually in Germany on leave, because I thought what he did was, to Benowitz, I didn't have enough information, but enough to say what he did was not with under the OSI directive. He's not supposed to go into anybody's home. They're not supposed to do what I was told they did, went in and rearranged the furniture just to screw poor Benowitz around. I don't know if you've heard that or not.
Yeah, well, I put it in the book because that's what he told me they did, and he said he was doing it under orders from another agency that was not the OSI.
Well, I can tell
doesn't excuse
you
it.
Bob Friend, who was OSI, in addition to being, you know, like a physicist and everything else, who was really a bright man, still working on missile development out on the West Coast.
Really?
Bob Friend,
yeah.
Colonel Friend.
Huh.
He said if that is true, those guys could have been, you know, really been read the Riot Act. That is illegal to do something like that. It doesn't matter who told them. That's not under the purview of the OSI.
Well,
harass people.
Yeah, well, the Doty did that one too many times and got drummed out of the service, so, or at least out of OSI.
Well, then that's what he deserved to have had happen. I've never met him personally, either one of them. I may be, you know, short being under, not really giving credit that's due, but my impression from everything I can figure out is there's two guys who love to screw around and make up stuff for their own entertainment. That's just my, you know, I hope I'm not wrong.
What was that?
I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, what, about Doty?
Yes.
What did you just say about him?
No, I just said that I hope that my impression was that there were two guys that really took too many liberties and were screwing around and doing a lot of improvising that was outside the purview of the OSI.
Well, I got that impression while I was working on the book, both talking to Doty, other people, and other OSI agents, actually. One that came in later, many years later, probably about 10 years after Doty was out. Maybe not that many years. 5 or 6 years after Doty was out. He said that they used Doty's example as something that you weren't supposed to do, as this person had gone too far.
I'm glad to hear that, because it certainly struck me as being that way. You know, I aren't they the ones that made up Serpo or the stories about Kraft? Everybody seems to change the Holloman thing. Like the Kraft came down, one officer got out and stayed with us. Another alien was in our custodian and died. And I mean, there are stories that are just outrageous.
Well, they run them together.
Since about the landing at Holloman.
Well, they run them together. Did you actually see that film?
I did not.
Did Shardle see the film?
Yes.
What did he describe to you that was in that film?
That there were three crafts hovering around. One of them looked like it was in distress, quote, to quote him. It came down, landed in the, you know, the fire department, and the base commander went out to greet it or do whatever they were going to do, and there seemed to be some sort of communication. And the door opened up and three beings came out. Unfortunately, the artist I used to drew them in the book and in our special, he is really an illustrator I used in advertising, and I didn't really oversee and didn't quite see what he had drawn, because he drew them like, you know, Superman or sort of characters in a comic book, and it made me very. I said, "Where did you get this?" He said, "Well, that Shardle described them, and that's what they sounded like to him." Well, I should have overseen that a little more, so that they did look a little more alien than they look like Babylonians. I'm not sure if that may be not true. They had a rope-like design. They had a little list. The devices in their ears and a wand that's supposed to be a translator. So it's a mystery to me. When I went to Holloman, I was free to wander around everywhere.
Huh.
I first went into the radar department, and there was a young officer who followed me a lot, but I said, "Look, I'm going to go to the John. I'll be right back." So I wandered in and met with the head of radar and just said, "Geez, interesting. I bet you guys were really surprised that day that thing flew in, that thing came in. I mean, it was fishing." He said, "Oh, yeah, you mean the flying bathtub?" I said, "Yeah, well, what did you think?" He said, "Well, we just don't talk about things like that." And I said, "Well, he said, "If you really want to know, you probably should ask the photographic team," which by the time I got over to the photographic team, the guy who was originally there had opened a rock shop somewhere else, and I just didn't pursue it any further. Another thing I said, because I had a sheet that described everything that happened from the time it landed, what rooms they were taken to, and there was a sort of a little hangar at the end of Mars Avenue I was told about where the craft was taken. So I got a young officer, when I say young, he was younger than me anyway, I think, in one of those blue sedans, and he said, well, okay, well, let's go down to the end of Mars Avenue, let's check it out. We arrived there, there was the building, the hangar.
Yeah.
And it was looked like it was pretty well abandoned, unless I've already told you this.
Nope.
He helped me pry the door open with a crowbar, and there wasn't anything in there except a few jet engines, and looked like, well, if something had been there, it wasn't there anymore, that's for sure. But the point was that all of the details that I was told about, including the person who was supposed to work there, who was part of the whole crew, I remember looking, I'm drawing a blank unless I remember his name, Alfonso Lorenzo, was the one that reported to Norton that this film was coming in, who was a friend of Chardel's.
Uh-huh.
So I was looking for him and his name in the directory for that year at Holloman. The guy who was our assistant director did find it in the directory. Now, I'll tell you something that happened after that. There was a CIA guy. Remember, this is unofficial. He just happened to be curious about what was going on. And Alan told him that Jed Wright-Patterson, probably he could find the name of Lorenzo in the directory. So he took it upon himself, unofficially. He went to Wright-Patterson and said, gee, I'd like to see your personnel directory for the 70s in, you know, Holloman Air Force Base. And they said to him, quote, well, we'll come back maybe tomorrow or the next day and we'll see if we can't locate it for you. I never met the agent, but he was a friend of Alan's. He said he went there to look at the old the booklet of people who were working at Holloman, and he said, oh, you know, I'm sorry, that's old, and I found out it had been destroyed. So, whether, you know, it's like a Kafka event. I don't know if he really was written in the book, or he was part of the personnel, or did they destroy it before someone was digging it up, or
did they just tell you that?
I don't know.
So, So did you actually talk to... You never really actually located anybody. Oh, here come the sirens we always get.
I know, I can hear you.
Yeah.
That knew about Lorenzo, you mean?
Yeah, well, did you ever get to talk to anybody... Wow, that's loud. Did you ever manage to talk to anybody who had actually been there and could describe to you what had happened that was in the film as a live witness?
I can't say we did. The only thing that we had a Major Verona.
Jack Verona, right?
He was a Pentagon sort of contact for us. I said, would you please look for Lorenzo, this name? It's important. He went off looking for, he said he had a reason to know, and wherever he searched, he came back and said he was upset, and he said, they told me there never was a person by that name, and that, you know, like bug off.
Huh.
Now, the story about Leo Verona, Major Leo Verona, who was very helpful with us most of the time.
Was
he's
that
the
Leo?
One who arranged for us to go down to Holloman and meet with the commander of the base.
Was it Leo or Jack?
No, his name was Leo.
Huh, this is different, because the one I'm thinking of is Jack Verona, but go ahead.
Well, Verona was... I thought this was funny, but maybe it isn't so funny. He was assigned very quickly to be a tennis instructor in Green Bay, Labrador, right after that, very quickly. And I just thought, is that a joke? Or, I mean, Alan, my partner, can tell you that he was really on our side, trying to help us figure out who these people were and where they were. But the fact that I didn't know he wanted to be a tennis instructor, I don't know if he did either.
Well, he probably
didn't.
Well, it sounds like he was either being too helpful or it was part of the plan to have him sort of disappear into the
That could be too. It's like
some kind of duty.
What kind of games do people play then?
Well, I think there's a lot of games going along in the going around in the intelligence game that we only see little bits of, and you saw a lot more than most people, so you've got a little bit more of a better handle on what people were doing and possibly why, especially since they had offered you this film to be used in this documentary, and then maybe you should describe to us what happened and how that got how the film got pulled back and how you weren't able to use it after all.
Well, I, you know, foolishly, naively expected that we'd have that as the conclusion of the film. So I was told that Coleman, because of all, the reasons are always, you know, endless number of logical reasons. He said they pulled it back because this was the time there was, you know, Nixon was in trouble and was politically not the right time to do it, so he ordered it to be driven back to the Pentagon, the film. And when I ask him about it later, it sort of gets all kind of mixed up with, well, it's because that thing was shot with certain kinds of lenses and we didn't want the Soviets to know that we had those kind of lenses. But my God, it was shot by the cameras down it and also a camera above in the helicopter. So, now, speaking of the helicopter, this was an interesting thing.
Yeah,
I think it was interesting. I wanted a shot from the helicopter, as I was told that one of them had observed this landing, and the Army didn't have a helicopter, but somebody spoke to the commander of the Army base. Now, why and how this came about, the word came back, well, go to the Army pad, and a helicopter will be waiting for you. So all of a sudden, the Army was cooperating in this very bizarre game. So we hopped in with the camera and myself and two guys with those bubble helmets, you know, black bubble helmets. They never said a word. They just kind of indicated, just kind of, well, I said, we'll go up and circle around, and we'd be filming it. We came back down, sat down, and nobody said anything. We got out and didn't even thank the guys. And I thought, how come the commander of the Army base was involved in this? It's like, where does the cooperation end, or does it ever end?
Yeah, what was the Army doing at Holloman? And that's an Air Force base, right?
Yes, but apparently Army occupies part of it.
Oh, okay. Well, that sort of makes sense.
What's that?
I suppose that sort of makes sense.
Yes, sort of. I don't know. A lot of things didn't quite make sense. Now, there were other things that probably of up-to-date type of things. The Seligman thing, you already know, that show was really not so good. I was thinking there were other things that happened with Alan and I that I thought were interesting. This had to do with when Technicolor was putting up the money for four-star films. Again, I'm jumping around just a little bit, but it's interesting, I thought. We had a Soviet with us for several days while we're shooting. By the way, Annie Spielberg was one of our line producers and was the one who suggested to her brother to review the UFO show because he was making his famous film that Hynek was in.
Yeah, Close Encounters.
Yeah, he was interested in it for. But there was a Soviet guy that was head of North American Affairs with us, which Alan never explained why he was there. He was always hanging around us, and confidentially, it's long past now, Annie was sort of interested in him. And the Soviets got wind of his interest in her and took him out of a hotel and back in New York and sent him back home. I thought, which is very bizarre what goes on behind the scenes, that you don't really understand what is going on. But the KBG was, you know, concerned that his job was to review the impression of North America and the Americans to the Soviet Union. But we couldn't have been nicer to him. We treated him so well. He'd go to some of our, you know, we'd have lunch or whatnot, and he was always hanging around. And then when the report that he wrote, it was rather scathing of America. But maybe that was his job.
That's probably his job from the beginning.
Job done. Well, anyway, that's kind of the best I can tell you about our, you know, that. By the way, I was just noticed here that Strieber came to our house along with Tracy Torme way back when, I guess when they were doing Fire in the Sky.
Yeah.
That was an interesting thing that my wife had fixed some dessert for them all, and they're all sitting around, and my wife offered them the dessert she had made, and he said, Strieber said, what is it? And he said, it's a chocolate something or other. And he said, no, they told me I can't eat chocolate or I die. So he gave the chocolate to his wife or something. It was very strange.
Who's
He's
they?
Kind of an odd guy, isn't he, Strieber?
Who's they? He said that his visitor friend said he couldn't eat chocolate?
Yes, the visitor friend said, stay away from chocolate because you could die from it. Unless I misunderstood what he was talking about. Maybe he just didn't want to have any chocolate ice cream or whatever.
Yeah, maybe he preferred strawberry. I don't know.
Well, this was... It doesn't matter. I'm throwing that in as kind of a side thing as I'm looking at this little thing for you. There was another incident that maybe we... I've wrote down a few notes so I'd know to tell you about them or talk about them.
Yeah, I've got a few questions
that,
people
you know,
wrote in, too.
Corso had come to our house. Did I mention that a long time ago?
No.
Yeah, he came along with a filmmaker, probably about, it would be maybe the early 80s. This is before anybody knew anything about him. And he sat down and wanted to know about our project and what we had done. And my impression was he knew very little about the UFO phenomenon. He told me that he had a file cabinet, and in that file cabinet he found a couple pictures of, quote, dead aliens, and a few technical things that were there. Now, you move forward in time, and he gets hooked up with Burns,
yeah.
And all of a sudden he starts talking about going into a hangar and prying open a box and seeing dead aliens in it. And so my impression was this man was, he wanted to leave a legacy for his family, so he was really influenced to write about things that he really didn't experience, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because he didn't know very much about, and I asked the other guys who, because he was at the Pentagon, foreign technology for the Army, but he really didn't have a very important job, and they never really knew much about him and really questioned whether he really, you know, took articles from a craft that landed in Roswell and sent them out to industry to develop. So my impression was, now that he's not here, it's probably unfair to say this, but I thought it was just an old gas bag.
But you said, because you said that all he described at the time, and this was in the 1980s, was finding in his filing cabinet a couple pictures of what supposedly looked like dead aliens.
That's exactly right. That's
and
what
then
he
his book came out.
Talked about. Yeah. And nothing, something technical things, maybe like some wiring of some sort, but nothing that, you know, that you would think he would send off to industry to develop into technology that now we use. It didn't make sense. I really think, from what I could gather, he was getting older. He wanted a legacy to leave to his children, and he was willing to be influenced by his co-writer to put just anything in. The fact that he said that he, in that Air Force base somewhere in the Midwest, that a friend of his said, come in, look into the warehouse, and he pried open the box and saw dead aliens. In my opinion, I will say, strike me down if I'm telling a lie, I just don't think that ever happened. It made the story and the book, you know, probably interesting.
Yeah, of course
it
did.
I would say that I took him with a grain of salt. That's all I can tell you. And I kept telling some of the Air Force people, that, why don't you call him? And they said, there's no reason to. So
they didn't mind, apparently.
I met like Coleman. Why don't he's right down in Florida with you? Why don't you talk to him? And he said, no, I don't want to bother. So that was interesting, huh?
Yeah, well, because there's probably, from what you're saying, it just sounds like they had nothing to say to him because he was saying nothing important to them.
Yeah, I think so. Now, let's come up to date. Several years ago, Kurt Brubaker called me and asked if I would provide a forensic hypnotist to regress John Burroughs. I did not know John Burroughs. You know who he is. He's the one at Bentwater who went up to the craft and touched it.
Oh, yeah.
So I was told, probably by Brubaker, to provide this hypnotist, but he didn't want me involved. I don't know. He thought maybe I was going to scoop him on his story. I had no interest in doing that, and I didn't want to go out to California anyway. So my friend was named Al Ward, forensic police hypnotist, who took John Burroughs back and said that he really was frightened to death under hypnosis, and revealed to him, which he never talks about now, even with Linda Howe leading the parade, he didn't really talk about the fact that he said under hypnosis that he said that the beings, through telepathic means or some other means, says, we used to be in your form, quote unquote, and they had come from 89 light years to the fourth quadrant, and how long it took them to get here. I checked some of that data with Bob Friend, who's, you know, should know, and we agreed about how many it took to get here. Yet, and the reason I brought this up is Al Ward came out when Linda Howe was at the conference here in Eureka Springs, maybe a little longer than that. So we had dinner together, and I got a chance to really meet John Burroughs. And the story got slightly watered down from what my impression was. He didn't seem to want to talk about what he experienced under hypnosis. And Linda wanted to keep Al Ward away from him, thinking, I suppose, that maybe Al knew more than she knows about what he experienced, John Burroughs. Penniton, the other sergeant, I really didn't get to meet him, but I know he's the other one that was present at that Bentwater
site. I think it was Penniston.
Penniston, that's right. I mean, they both just seem like really nice people. And I sort of say, what John Burroughs witnessed, Penniston, is really about a continuation of what Lonnie Zamaro saw years and years ago when a craft landed and the beings, you know, stuck their feet down below and then saw him and then took off with a roar. And then also, I think Gordon, one of the astronauts witnessed a craft, not directly, but on film that he was filming. So, it's no mystery that we have had encounters with other crafts. Whether they're ours, I don't know. Some people think, well, maybe it's, just some of our advanced craft. Except, I didn't tell you about, I suppose, or do you care, that in the 80s, I was called to go to Norton Air Force again to get involved in another UFO show.
I was going to ask you about that, and Grant Cameron told me that this time, this was when Valet and J. Allen Hynek would have been involved.
Yeah, they all went out there. Well, this general, General MacArthur, General, well, it doesn't matter. I don't want to get their names mixed up. I should know them all. I went out to Norton, and Bob Scott was the commander of the DAVA, Defense Audio Visual Agency, and a General Miller, Glenn E. Miller, was second in command and a retired general. And Hynek came out with his friends from Arizona, you know, whatever that organization he belonged to, and we met at our house because I wanted Miller to meet him, meet Hynek and his group. And then Hynek, we were having coffee, and then finally General Miller came in a little late and just floored Hynek by saying, "Well, they're voice activated." And Hynek said, "What?" Apparently there was a craft that first was at Norton, which was a mock-up, taken up to, I guess, Vandenberg. I don't know if he really saw one, but the way he described it, he said he saw it on the inside. And Hynek, track with me, if you will. Margaret, my wife, watched Hynek's face drop as he started talking about the interior and how they worked. And it, all of a sudden, I think it occurred to Hynek that he had been left out of so much. And I was told Hynek was never given a top-secret clearance anyway because it cost too much. So I think Hynek was realizing that maybe he was left out of the loop. That was my observation of my wife.
But Hynek, listening to this, suddenly believed that there was some sort of craft that had been captured or re-engineered and was voice-activated?
Yes.
Hynek believed this, right?
And that's what Miller told me, too, which surprised me. I thought, this is a strange thing to be bringing up just so off the wall, almost. But it happened so... And then I... Well, anyway, so that's what happened. And then Chartel said, "Well, why don't you guys all come out to Norton and look at some UFO footage if you want to?" And that's what we're... Shock went out there, and Hynek was there, and they're all there, and nothing ever happened.
Oh, really. He didn't show them any of the films?
No. What happened was General Miller said to Paul Chartel, "I want you to show them all the UFO material." And Chartel, who was head of security and everything, said, "Sir, I can't do that unless you give me a written order." And I remember he said to him, "Written order, I'll have your ass." Well, I guess it just ended that nobody got to see anything.
It also sounds like they were putting on an act of some sort, the way you describe it.
It could be, but for what reason? I never could figure out what would the reason be.
Well, I don't know what the reason is either, except to sort of... muddy the waters about what they knew, how much they knew about what the phenomenon was and what caused it, etc. It seems like, to me, Bob, it seems like the whole history of this, which you've been describing to me and what a lot of other people have told me in all my interviews, all the stuff I've done for writing my books and articles, is that the U.S. government sort of knows that there, well, they definitely know that there's something here. And something interacting with us that is not understandable by us yet completely, and certainly not controllable or predictable. And if there's any kind of cover-up, there's a cover-up more of ignorance than of we're working with them and all that, you know, all the stuff that the wildest conspiracy type people might say.
I so second that. My impression was we do not have any in-depth understanding of what it is. I think Jacques Vallée came very close to explaining how it could happen, which is, and makes the most sense to me, is that whatever these vehicles are or beings, if they're in a little higher dimension than we are, like a fourth or fifth dimension, and they slow their frequencies down, all of a sudden they're going to appear in our third dimension. And that, as Hynek used to say, that people reported when they came, pulled out, you could hear, they would report the clapping of molecules together as if you just pulled a cork out of something or their craft out of our atmosphere. So I don't, the idea of, and also of disclosure, it makes me laugh. I think these people are chasing their tails on this disclosure thing. What do they mean by disclosure? Do they really think that, you know, the president and the secretary and the head of DOT and everything is going to get up and say, well, here's the truth of it. I think that they don't know. I don't think if we've had any contact, it's not in any depth of understanding. And I think people are chasing their tail on this disclosure stuff. When I spoke at the X conference about 2 years ago, I felt I was alone in what I was saying. I said, look, all of these Air Force guys admit the reality of it. What more do you want? They don't say, oh, it's bullshit. It doesn't exist. They all acknowledge it. It's just that they really have no ability to explain it. And I don't think anybody, I'm always bothered by people who are in communication with these different alien groups from other planets. That really puzzles me. Although people say that they have these exchanges.
I don't know. I tend to think that maybe a few of them do. But what the exchange is with some source that may be outside of their minds, but where that comes from, they're going to make the assumption that it's from another planet or wherever, because I don't think there's any way for them to know, or whatever the source is tells them that, so that they believe that. I mean, that's an idea that Valet put forward in Messengers of Deception.
Yes. I think that there is a possibility of doing some sort of telepathic communication. In fact, Alan Sandler and I were going to do another program on this whole subject, and we said the cornerstone of this is telepathy. If we can, it's like the guys who were doing remote viewing. I would think that they were very geared to possibly break into that right brain, out of your body, telepathic communication, although they never said that they did any of it.
Well, they said that they kind of touched the edge of it and were sort of able to control it, but not completely. And my idea when talking, and I have talked to Putoff and Joe McMonagle.
McGonagall. He's a big guy.
Lynn Buchanan, all these people. My idea is that that the only way to access some of this stuff that we're talking about, this telepathy or whatever you want to call it, is or whatever this other is, if they are aliens, is through our minds. It's not through some instrument or through sitting in some time machine or whatever. It's some sort of method, technology, or whatever that lets our minds do the work of accessing this dimension, whatever it may be.
I totally agree. And, you know, it's going to be a hard thing to... I don't know. I never exchanged too many ideas with him, but I'd love to know. I think he had experience by remote viewing the moon once or something. Do you recall that?
Who was this? You faded out for a second.
Oh, I was saying, I really think the key to it is two things. Our remote viewers are open to maybe making this contact if they knew how to control it. It's just like, you know, the yogis teach you how to get outside your body and traveling. And apparently our remote viewers are capable of doing that. And I think that's the way we're going to communicate. I don't think that... I think it's something that will awaken within all of us, that eventually we will have that ability developed. I just think we're like juniors in the universe who are just starting to wake up.
Yeah, I think that's the point at which that's the disclosure that's going to happen, is the change in people on a democratic level, not the government telling us what they know, because I don't think they know really much of anything.
I agree.
I think people's ideas and their way of looking at the world and our standards of evidence, how we do research, how we accept evidence need to change before any of this changes and before anybody can accept that there's something else besides us present, at least on a mental level, I guess if you want to call it.
You know, I told you that my partner has also just finished doing a project with the Chinese. Hey, really, we're going to do a film project with a Chinese film company. And I started off wanting to do, well, let's compare our our societies and our habits and our interests and, you know, and that just seemed to, I had a Chinese writer I had to work with and it just didn't work, so I abandoned that. But then I remember Putoff's material that I still had, that I had for 5 or 10 years on his experiments with the Chinese in paranormal. And I thought, this is so interesting, where under the DIA's sponsorship, they went over there and Putoff, as you probably know, was doing experiments with objects being teleported from one room to the other. Are you familiar with that?
Do you read the Society for Scientific Exploration Journal?
I don't. I probably should.
There was an article in the very latest issue by a Chinese researcher just about that very subject, and what he said was, we do things differently here, we treat the subjects differently, and we don't expect results right away or on demand, which is why I think we're finding better results than you might get in the West. And he was nice about the way he said it, but I understood exactly what he was talking about.
Could you email me maybe that, not the article, but just what year or what date or something? Let me go back to what I did. I asked Alan, I said, Alan, here's all the data. Here are the scientists that Putoff was working with. Here are the universities. Here are the names of the people who did these experiments.
Uh-huh.
And because we had the names. You know, the most amazing one was an object that was put in the hand of one young Chinese kid. And he would hold it in his hand and he would say, it's going, it's going, it's going, it's gone. And the object, which is the size of a small matchbox, would be gone. And in the other room, and they had really set it up so it, you know, isolated two rooms. In the other room, the kid would say, it's coming, it's coming, it's, and there would appear. They even had an electronic beep that would go with it. So you would hear beep, 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 and he said, it's going, beep, beep. It disappeared in the other room. You'd hear beep, 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 and it appeared in his hand. Now, this was experiments that were documented. I saw little visuals of it. And taking objects like jelly beans, and I won't say they were in jelly beans, they were in a, they would be able to work one of them down and out the side of the glass without bringing it, and it would be, end up on the outside. I have pictures of that. So I said, Alan, tell them that this is what we want to do. We want to go and explore all of this.
Yeah.
When he, apparently the government vets everything that goes through China. So when he requested that, the answer was very short and sweet. Oh, we don't believe in things like that.
Who said that?
But the Chinese, when we said, I wanted to do that. And what happened, what I realized is that the DIA was the sponsor of these experiments, and maybe they were just saying, oh, no, we don't want to talk about anything like that. That's because your intelligence community was involved in the first one. That's the only thing I can think of. Because they just, of course, Alan tried to reach me, one of the university people. Didn't work out as far as I know, but I'd love, now that would be worthwhile. Television special.
That would be great. And I think from what you just said, I understood it right at the end there. They think that you're a front for something. Or he is.
Well, I don't know what thought, but they thought, but we're trying to get back in their pants again about their paranormal stuff. That's the only thing I could think of. Now, I'll tell you about the funny outcome of all of this. When that died, Alan continued on and did sort of a, what would you call it, a realistic comedy-type thing, and he wrote it, and he said, well, what happens if we send a young kid over to China, and he lives with a Chinese family, and we'll just make it a humorous situation comedy,
which they went along with.
I ended up writing the opening, and in fact, the lyrics are over on my piano right now, which were, what am I doing in China? You know, everybody asking, am I ever coming back? What am I doing in China? So they recorded that, and that was part of it, and that was the end of, I mean, so I was told, put off, I went from paranormal to parasilly in one leap. But, you know, I realize it was a dead issue unless it's approached. Maybe you need a scientist to approach them to really pursue. They seem to be ahead of us.